in the 16th chapter, 1 Corinthians. In the 20th verse, it says that the God of peace will bruise Satan under your feet shortly. An interesting statement. Shortly has a very broad meaning here. And maybe it just means suddenly there will come a point where Satan is through. Now, I think to make use of a statement like that properly, we have to understand, first of all, that Satan is ultimately going to be taken care of. Now, today people may feel like shouting the victory song, and then I suppose you can, except that there's an awful lot of trouble and affliction and distress still going on here. But we can be very confident that in the end, Satan will be overcome. In a very real sense, he has already been overcome in that he can't get at that which is the vital part of our lives, the spirit. This whole fleshly milieu, that is this world that we live in, and the carcasses we live in along with it, this whole thing is a secondary thing. You see, when you're born in this world, you are born with a certain set of genes that you have nothing to do with. And those genes may leave you with personality problems or with life problems that are not all that easily handled. There are sometimes physical problems that do affect our life style, our life meaning and purpose and so forth. And for many people in this world, their entire life is a trial. For example, people with muscular dystrophy and any number of 1,000 different common afflictions, for some people have made their lives, all the days on the earth, a trial, a problem. Now, what about those people, you see? Are they less favored than anyone else? You see? Well, God has allowed, they've been born into the world with a certain kind of affliction, a certain kind of problem. But it isn't only physical problems, there are psychological problems. For example, the functioning of our brains is so tied in to the levels of enzymes, the presence of enzymes, enzymes that metabolize the proteins out of the blood into the nerve cells and so forth. See, there, those enzymes, whether they are there or not, will determine whether the certain areas of the brain are getting proper nourishment. It's like blood circulation. See, if you don't have good circulation in your feet, you're going to wind up with problems in your feet, you see. And so in the brain, circulation of signals, nerve signals, you see, the process of transmitting signals in the brain takes place in the metabolizing, that is, the transference of proteins from the bloodstream into the nerve cell. These proteins are metabolized, assimilated, through the activity of enzymes. Enzymes are the substances that break down the proteins. Through these enzymes, they develop the transmitter chemicals like dopamine, solanin, epinephrine, other things that transmit the signals or that sometimes block the signals. You've got transmitters and then you've got elements that negate or that block the signals. And those are used in pain, for example. The body has its own usage of enkephalins and endorphins and so forth that theoretically are the built-in pain blockers, you see. If you have a lack of dopamine, which is one of the transmitter chemicals, then the result of that is lethargy, slowness of movement, and so forth. In fact, that's what the lithium, for example, is supposed to do, what they give in the mental hospital, is to block the dopamine and to slow down the activity, because the whole idea is, it's better that they more or less vegetate than that they're violent. See, better a vegetable than violent is sort of the attitude. Whereas in the old days, they used to put them in straitjackets. Now they just give them lithium. I think it's a very risky thing. But what I'm trying to say to you is that the very action of the brain depends upon the presence or absence of certain chemical substances, just as in the levels of hormones in the endocrine system, such as adrenaline, thyroxine, adrenocorticotropic hormone, and so forth. All these hormones that are the essence of our whole metabolism, but more than that, the way we respond to stress. All of these things are chemical and therefore are dependent upon the biochemical pattern, which is in turn dependent upon the genes. Now, why am I going into all that? For simple reason that a lot of the problems that we have or struggle with all our life are genetic, even in the financial end of things. There are some people who just can't handle money. Wouldn't matter how much money they would make, the degree of their indebtedness will be directly proportionate to the increase of their income, because the more, for some people, if they get a $20 a month raise, they spend $40 a month in new accretions, new indebtednesses, and so forth. And they just, why do they do this? A lot of people are just can't handle money. Now, this kind of person, when couples get married, they're kind of, I do this when I counsel them. Let's just look at that picture first. How are you at handling money? See, so this one young woman, she was having a lot of difficulty with money, and I said, now you let him handle, because the fellow was very good at that. I could see he really was. And I said, you listen to him. You let him tell you how to handle money. Learn from him. When he handles the money, because he knows how to do it and you don't. Now, that's a good way to get started, because then, if it happened to be the other way, I would have to say the other thing, even in, in the, maybe some question in some people's minds is who handles the checkbook and who makes the money, financial decisions, so forth. Sometimes it has to be, I think sometimes a woman will do it, because she may be more adept than the man. So you have to look at that, be honest about appraising that whole thing. But, well, I'm bringing that up because a lot of people don't realize that. But sometimes just the very capacity to handle money is genetic. So you know the kind of person, almost everything they touch turns to money, and you know the person, everything they touch turns to dust. It doesn't matter what kind of business deal they go into, it's going to go sour, see? Genetic. Now, that is in the interest of saying that rather than spending a lifetime trying to become perfect, we learn to cope with what we have. Now, we have to fairly evaluate it. We can't just, be careless about it. For example, in this matter of money, you can't just say, well, I don't know how to handle money, so I'll just spend all I can get. No, you have to try till you learn, and you have to take measures. If you know your weakness, then you take the measures you need to handle it. So, for example, a person has a tough time hanging on to money, doesn't want to take $100 in their purse and go around to the shops, you see. leave the money at home. And the checkbook and the credit cards too. Well, let us say this: the person that has trouble handling money should not have credit cards. Burn the credit card, tear them up, cut them up, send them back. Because you're just vulnerable. Now, this, you can't say I'm going to fight with this till I learn how. You just better take the best way that you can and say I just am never going to really learn how to save, so I'm just going to get rid of credit cards. I have to say it too, because people struggle with these things all their life, and they think I'm no good because I can't do this and I can't do that. And some people can't cook, some people can't sew, some people can't do carpentry. Some people have a very mild temperament. One situation, which a fellow has a very mild temperament, and he was proposing to marry a girl who has a very aggressive temperament. And he said he just didn't want somebody telling him what to do all his life. And I said, well, I mean, given the situation, I'm afraid to. So I said, well, what should I do? Should I become more macho? I said, no. I said, marry somebody that is compatible with a mild temperament. I said, this is part of your life. This is your personality structure. Going back to your parents and your forebears and so forth and your circumstance, all the circumstances and all the genes and all the activities of that particular person all moved him in one direction, and the entire structure of the other person moved her in the other direction. Now, it's silly for people like that to get married. I'm not telling you don't get married. I'm just telling you, if you don't like what you see now, you know, he said, well, I said there are going to have to be some changes. I said, don't kid yourself. Not going to be any changes. I said, otherwise, you spend all your life fighting with that, trying to handle that situation. See, now, there's a very important case in point. I told him, don't try to become a different person yourself, and don't expect the other person to become different. Just cope with what you've got. Handle what you've got. Now, you think maybe I'm way out in a brush. No, I'm saying to you, face the realities of your situation. Whether your situation is dependent upon factors beyond your control or factors that you in the past might be responsible for. You marry the wrong person, or you make the wrong move, you take the wrong job. Look at your present circumstances. Recognize that those present circumstances are what they are, for better or for worse. That's what they are. You may have made wrong decisions. You're in this position, and especially given the fact that a lot of these things are going to be changed, and probably you shouldn't even try. But make the best of what you got. Don't go down the road of assuming the Lord has got to make your spiritual situation and your fleshly situation match. A lot of people think that. That if they're really in touch with Christ, he's going to smooth out all of these earthly problems. Well, some that just aren't getting smoothed out. I suppose that a person with muscular dystrophy, for example, could get healed. It's not beyond the Lord's power to do that, but I don't see it. Now, what about that poor soul that has to spend all her life with the problem of muscular dystrophy? That's a bum rap. That's tough. I can't even justify it. I don't blame God, but I can't say what the reason for it is. Or I can't say it's fair. Why some people have to lie in a hospital bed and other people are out running around, it's beyond our comprehension. But the vital issue here is that, after all, the whole thing is a temporary earthly shell. And whereas a lot of people might think Satan has the upper hand because he has been able to perpetrate these things on humanity, all he is doing is fooling around with the shell. The inner spirit he can't get at, and the inner spirit runs consistently through all of this. Whatever problems you're facing, the Spirit of Christ is with you, standing with you in your battle. Not necessarily to change everything, but to hold you steadfast in the midst of it. Now, I go down that road because there are so many circumstances. It's so easy to say, oh, well, if you come to Christ, you'll change all of this. No, it just doesn't happen that way. I've been around too long. And some people get circumstances changed, but for a lot of people, there's no way the circumstances are going to change, see? And we can't assume that God is favoring one over another. And of course, the most heinous of all judgments is if you had enough faith, your circumstances would be changed. I think that's criminal. That's as criminal as a quack doctor putting a copper tube in somebody's mouth and telling them they're going to get healed of cancer. That's criminal. I think the pleasant platitudes that some give out in the name of Christ are criminal. They're in the realm of quackery because they raise false hopes. And the disappointment is so shattering. But more deeply than that, the burden of guilt, which I have to deal with constantly, is pretty heavy on a person who feels that if only they had enough faith, their child would be healed or they would be healed. That's too big a guilt trip to put on anybody. Certainly we humans have no right to put that on anybody. And it's the height of egotism to assume that we have faith, but somebody else doesn't. You know, that we're the reason our circumstances are better is because we have more faith. Now that's the height of presumption and egotism. The answer is really most sensible in the way that we're presenting it. The spirit within, being vitalized by Christ, gives capacity to cope with the circumstances without and remains the steadfast stream of support and strength that we have in the midst of all the circumstances. We make mistakes, but again, it's very, very gracious or very, very unsound for us to press that point. For example, it's again easy to say, well, it's all your own fault, it's your own doing. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. You marry the wrong person, for example, and I don't think we are naive enough to believe that many people marry the right person. You know, you know what I really mean? We talk about Mr. Right or Miss Right that comes along, and it's a pipe dream for the most part. I don't know how all the Mr. Rights turn out to be so Mr. Rotten so early. But you know how it is. Everybody talks about, oh, this is Mr. Right, you know, and so off they go on their tooch, you see. But, you know, later on, a year down the road, or 2 years, or 6 months, or 6 weeks, whatever it is, down the road somewhere, it all turns sour. Say, all right, now then you have to settle in, and people do settle in to live with that person for the long haul. And they make the best of it and so forth. But now you see, to come along to a person like that and say, well, you see, it's your own fault. Well, there are a lot of things in that. For example, where were the pastors that were supposed to be talking to these young people? One pastor I know, and probably a lot like it, who says, well, somebody's going to marry him anyway, so I mean, they're going to go get married whether I do it or not. So that person goes ahead and marries. I'm astounded at the number of pastors that marry couples without a pretty substantial counseling process. I take at least 6 weeks. If I can bring six sessions in a little shorter time, I might do it. But generally speaking, I wouldn't marry anyone short of 6 weeks of time to counsel. Many times I've said, you better wait 6 months and then we'll talk about it again. Not 6 months, 9 months. Now, so I have to say, if there's a couple that has gotten married injudiciously, that, you know, I have to ask, where was the pastor that didn't give them the right guidance in the thing? People that make business mistakes. Now, where was the training in the early years? What was the father when he should have been teaching a kid how to handle money? Now, some are genetic problems, but there's also the other angle that maybe fathers aren't just teaching their young people how. In the early years when they'll listen, there comes a time when they won't listen, of course. It isn't quite fair just to put the blame on the mistake a person made without going back to the roots of why they made that mistake in the first place. Where were the counselors? Where were the guides in their life? Where were the people that should have been helping them? Where were the examples in the home that they should have had? So in part, we make our own mistakes. In part, we are to blame for the mistakes we make. But in part, it's part of our what training we had or didn't have. And then in the larger view, all of us are victims of the fall, see? All human fleshly folly is the result of the original intrusion of Satan into the world through the disobedience of Adam and Eve. I'm very reluctant to judge and very reluctant to put guilt and blame on, because there's just such a great complex number of things behind your lives, who you are and why you are what you are, why you make the moves you do, why you make the mistakes you do. I know in those very same family, some young people just seem to make all the mistakes and the others seem to get along pretty well. You have your black sheep syndrome. I don't ever use it with young people except to help get them over the hurdle, you know, to get rid of the idea. But why is one child better than another? Why is one child more orderly or organized or well-behaved than another? Now, it isn't to say people are not responsible. I think everybody's responsible for their actions. But some people have a tougher time controlling things in one area or another area, see. This has got to be a whole syndrome of a pattern of behavior that is part of their genetic background and environmental background. Now, all of that, I'm going back to this verse. The God of peace will bruise or trample, in a way, Satan under your feet shortly, or quickly, perhaps. The ultimate end of things is that all of the mischief and turmoil and turbulence that is in the world as a result of Satan is going to one day come to an end. And all that Satan has been able to do is disrupt the surface, but he is not able to get at the Spirit. The reason we know the Spirit of Christ is still with you is that you still are concerned about these things. Eh? Had a very interesting talk with my eldest daughter here a couple of weeks ago, and then with my granddaughter, teenage young lady, because they had come to a point of stalemate in their relationship, locking horns. So something had to be done to break down the thing there. So I had a chat with him. It was a very interesting chat with the oldest, with his daughter, who was having the very exact same problems with her daughter that I had with her. And the teenage daughter wanted to go to a certain concert, rock concert, and my daughter did not want her to go. The very thing my daughter would have strained at the leash to go at herself, you know. And so she was all up in arms. I said, well, now tell me something. I said, suppose now that the situation were as it was before, and you wanted to go, and I didn't want you to go. Now, what would you do? She said, well, she said, I suppose I'd have probably tried to go anyway, sneak out. And I said, well, you see, it's not all so simple that you can say you can't go here and you can't go there. I said, you have to make a choice. You have to decide whether you think she ought to go. And I said, if you think she shouldn't go, I'm certainly in agreement with you on that. And I told her, I can remember the times you ran from the room shouting, I hate you, when I didn't let you do something you wanted to do. She understood a lot of things that she wouldn't admit she understood. But I knew that, you know, and I told her. She said, well, I didn't hate you. And I said, I knew that. I didn't make any issue of it because I knew you didn't hate me. You were just fighting me, that's all. Anyway, in this point, there's a genetic flow that exists between parents and children, and no textbook in the world can handle that. You can read all the textbook answers on child development and so forth, developmental psychology. They're all very general. Parents who get books on this sort of thing are missing out on one important point. When you take developmental psychology, one of the chief things that keeps coming through in the classroom of where we're taking the course is, don't put all that much weight on this. It's only general. But a parent will get hold of a book like that and they'll think that's gospel just because it's printed. Every child acts like that at the given age, you see. When the child reaches 2 at the stroke of midnight, all of a sudden it's going to become the terrible 2s, you see, and the ornery 3s and whatever else. Now, you may think this is a far field. You may say, well, I don't have any children, so I don't even have to listen to what you're saying. Wrong. you are a child of God. And a lot of the things that we talk about in terms of parent-child relationships are applicable in terms of our relationship to Him. And if we can project a bit of what a good parent, a reasonable or successful parent, will think of and involve themselves with in the child, it'll help us to understand our relationship to Christ. So, for example, as I've often said to you, don't throw a child out of the house for making some bad move if you're a wise parent. And there's a certain amount of grace that has to be exhibited here. But the thing to understand is we're children of God. What that says over and over and over again is we're in this great milieu. There's this great sphere called the earth, this life stream, if you will. And we have all kinds of problems with it, ups and downs and ins and outs, just like a family has, you see. The family goes through many, many different kinds of experiences, some very traumatic, some pleasant, and so forth. But all of these forces are at work in the development of a family. Yet, we cope with these things and we get through them. And in the end, if we don't cut off communication, that's one of the big things, and in the end, the children continue to relate to it. We have to settle down for the long haul. And some of these textbooks of idealism, it's fantasy land, and it might be all right if you had the child for a week, you could do all of those things. But when you think in terms of having to do this for 20 or 30 or 40 years, which is true, you don't ever get rid of your children. If you think you're going to, you're kidding yourself, right? And this old line, well, it's my life, you know, baloney, it's our life. And all the rest of their days on the earth, or your days on the earth, you're going to be involved in one way or another. The bailout time comes, you know, and all this sort of thing. If I could convey something here, it's like a sack of cats. All of us. If you take your own family situation, all the ups and downs and the traumas and the problems and the trials and the laughter and the weeping, all the rest of it, put it all in one big sack. And that's a family milieu. And the successful family, the successful parents learn to roll with the punch, you see. Successful parents learn just to keep the channel open and to do the best you can with what you've got and not get too intense. Don't get tense about it. Don't get panicky. Don't run scared, see. As I always tell parents, that don't run scared. Young people have to get the vibe that you know where you're going and whether they know it or not. As I used to have to tell my young people, now I know where I'm going. I know what I'm doing. I don't know whether you know where you're going or not, but I know where I'm going. And this is what I think is right for you in this situation, you see. And then all the emotions come tumbling in. And I've always had to say, well, your emotions don't change the facts at all. Not at all. It doesn't even move me. The decision is just as sound before you burst into tears as after, see. If it's a sound decision before the tears, it's a sound decision after the tears, see. And I've always told parents, don't back down just because of the emotional outbursts and so forth. Okay, well, the point about all of that is this. If you are going to be successful with your young people, you have to give them the sense that, A, you care about them, B, you weren't born yesterday, and C, you're going to be firm about your conclusions, and D, that whatever happens, you're still their friend. So you're still their parent, and you're in there with them. And you're flexible. Now, it's a bigger picture that I'm drawing, however. Take that same milieu, that same sack of cats, and expand it into God's family. Now make the same application. God is the ultimate Father, the most wise, patient, long-suffering Father. If you as a parent can be somewhat patient or long-suffering, which you may or may not be, but if you have any modicum of long-suffering, think how much God has for us. But again, when you take the family milieu and you think of all the conflicts, the scrapping, the fighting, all the stuff that goes on there, and you say that goes on in God's family too, and it does. It's idealistic to think it doesn't. And if you know some fellowship where everybody's just lovely, somebody's covering up something. I don't know what. The thing that encourages me about our outfit down there is that it's perfectly normal that everybody's, they're just living and scrapping and making up, and it's part of what Paul ran into in the Corinth. If you think your fellowship is going to ever be any better than the Corinthian fellowship, you're kidding yourself. And they were fighting, and they were envious and jealous and petty and all the rest of it. To have a group of people like that, you almost have to be a master psychologist just to keep afloat, you know. And God presides over His family. But you see, He's not bent on shoring everybody up to be perfect in their applications. He wants their hearts. There isn't even in the whole Greek Testament the word perfect as we understand it is not there. You have either the word for mending and repairing or the word for fulfillment, consummation. But Christian people get too intense about themselves and their self-improvement processes. I don't mean that we ought not to behave ourselves. We should behave ourselves, yes. But there's an intensity that works contrary and puts people in such a state that on the one hand they can't be gracious to anybody else. That's one of the big problems with that kind of intensity in the church. People are so intent on being perfect they don't allow any imperfections in anybody around them. And they lose the grace, they lose the ability to relate to other people that aren't as noble as they are. There are certain groups of people that have specialized spiritual experiences, and if you don't have that experience, you're just substandard, that's all. Now that's what I call intense application. Just relax. The most secure child, self-assurance, is the one that is able to go out and play in the yard and not have to keep running back every 5 minutes to jerk on mother's skirt to see if she's still there. The child that always has to reassure itself is insecure. The same thing is true in our faith. This is always this constantly intense effort to get signals from God that He's still with us. We always either get God to prove Himself to us or prove ourselves to Him. That represents insecurity. If you can go off to work in the morning and do your job at the bench or wherever you are and just trust the Lord with your life and come back home at night and eat your dinner and go to bed or tend to whatever fascinations that you have, your television or reading, whatever. But anyway, I mean, that sounds a little earthy. But the point is, if you can just go along in your life and have that inner deep assurance that Christ is there without having to always make an issue of it, that is probably the deepest expression of worship you can ever give. The quiet confidence of the Lord is there. Now, if you like to sing praises to the Lord, that's fine. If you do it as something that just comes from the heart, like you send your give your wife or children or husband or whatever a birthday card, there is expression of love and whatnot. If it's done that way, if a person is just very happy to have Christ around and want to say something to him about that, that's fine. But the tendency in the church is to assume that the more spiritual you are, the more you will always be saying things and doing things to express that. That's a faulty notion. It's that quiet confidence that you know God's in charge of things and He's taking you through that is the greatest expression of faith. And not even getting things changed necessarily. The ability to be at peace in spite of no change is a greater expression of faith than the constant assumption that God has to change things. Just be at peace. You're a member of the family. We're all here in this family together. We're not a machine. We're not an organization. We're not a promotion. We're not a crusade. We're a family. And the tendency to turn is something I talked about a while ago, a few weeks ago, and my intention was to merely point out that to turn the family of God into a crusade or a marketeering process destroys the basic essence of the meaning of our relationship to Him as a family. The Lord has gifts of certain for certain ones to perform, and they do that. If the Lord has given you a gift, you'll do it. It's not something you have to push. You see, if you haven't any inclination at the present to do a particular thing, don't do it. Like I say to Boise Institute, if it doesn't flow, don't go. Go with the flow. Go, let your life flow. If you have the capacity to speak or to teach or whatever, it'll come out in God's time. Some members of the family are involved in the family business, for example, and they're a little different than the children who are going off to school. Just depends on where your gifts are, what your life is like. But if I can only get across this point of just relax and see yourself as a member of the family, and you have problems that you cope with, that you work with, you try to change things sometimes when they need it, you have habits that ought to be probably looked at, maybe corrected or whatever. You're responsible for your life, and if you make mistakes, you may have to pay the bill. If you jump off the roof, you're going to break your legs, you know, or you're going to injure yourself. You see, God doesn't alter the flow of gravity just so you can do your own pleasure. So you may pay for these mistakes, but that doesn't mean you're not a family. Go through the turbulence of your life, work things out, trust Christ. Remember, and in final, in closing here, remember that faith is not what you feel about God, but what God is doing in you. Faith is a divine process in you that is what holds you to God. If you didn't have faith, you wouldn't even be here tonight, see? That's what faith is. Not feeling good about God or feeling good about your circumstances or being even convinced He's going to do something. Many, many people have been just talked themselves into believing the Lord was going to heal someone. And they just keep talking themselves into believing. Then the person dies. Then they're devastated. And then they feel, well, I just didn't have enough faith. It wasn't had nothing to do with how they felt about faith. It was had to do with what God had in mind for the situation. We don't know what He has in mind. And if He's going to heal someone, He's already had that in mind long before your emotions got into the act. If He's not going to heal them, then He's not going to. So, I think we better stop. Father, we ask You to take these words and use them for Your glory, for Your purpose. We know they all have to be translated into each person's own psyche, and we ask that You'll do that. In Christ's name, amen.